Right, thank you, Big Samsung. My name is Helen Zhang, and I'm one of the co-founders of Intrigue Media. I think when we had founded Intrigue, my co-founder and I, 3.5, 4 years ago, it was with the idea of making local news more accessible and entertaining for everyone. And so we, you know, looking back the last few years, it's been quite a ride. Going from the daily newsletter, which is now going out to 140,000 or so readers from around the world, to building Election Intrigue, which is written by a Christian who's trying to run away for us right now, focused on how foreign policy actually impacts the world in US elections. So please keep an eye on that, as you know, we're coming up towards the election in a couple of weeks. And then now also we've got an events board, which is led by Taylor, and I'm sure you'll see him somewhere here, he'll come up to say hi. So it's been quite the journey, and we're very, very proud of the community that we've built and the quality of the content we're putting out, because I think more has changed in the world in the last 3 years than the last 30 years. And it's increasingly important to have access to growing, reliable, and apolitical, geopolitical global affairs briefings. So with that, I just want to say thank you for being here, and please come and see one year after that to see if you want to do an event with Intrigue and be a part of the community. So I would love to also introduce Eric Chamarkin to the stage. Eric is a senior director and public policy counsel of US Public Affairs for Samsung Electronics America. Of course, cybersecurity is a topic that's always at the front of everyone's attention. So Eric is Samsung's resident expert on the subject. Eric, please join us on the stage for a few words.
Thank you, Helen, and on behalf of Samsung's DC team, welcome to our office. And special thanks to Intrigue for hosting tonight's event. As you said, my name is Eric Tamarkin, and I lead cyber policy for Samsung here in Washington. Samsung's trusted and secure ecosystem of products includes semiconductors, batteries, 5G network equipment, mobile devices, TVs, and home appliances. As you might imagine, policymakers are really interested in the suite of products that we make, so it keeps our team quite busy here in Washington. But let me briefly tell you about three policy areas in cybersecurity that we've been focused on. First, IoT cybersecurity. As a leading manufacturer of connected devices, we are one of the initial supporters of the U.S. Cyber Trustmark program and participated in the White House launch last summer. Now we're working closely with our industry and government partners to support the successful implementation of the program and make sure that our customers and the IoT ecosystem are secure. Second, 5G security. We're also committed to building secure 5G networks and have appreciated the ongoing partnership with the State Department in the effort to deploy global trusted telecom. And third, AI. This past summer, we are honored to be named as a finalist in DARPA's AI Cyber Challenge, a two-year AI-based cybersecurity competition. Now look, cybersecurity is a team sport, and public-private collaboration among trusted companies, allied countries, and the US government is critical to the success of the team. And that is why we are so pleased to have senior representatives from the State Department, Department of Defense, and a former DHS CISA colleague and leader here tonight. As we reach the home stretch of Cybersecurity Awareness Month, you're in for a terrific conversation tonight. After the speakers, please check out some of the kiosks here. Just check out our defense-grade products. Enjoy the rest of the evening, and if you haven't had an opportunity yet, go out to the rooftop balcony for a nice view of the Capitol. And with that, back to you, Helen.
I'll be heading up to the rooftop in case anyone's arriving. I'd love to welcome to the stage now our first speaker for the evening, Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Cybersecurity of the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Cybersecurity and Digital Policy, say that three times, Lisa France. So LISL coordinates the cyber policy issues across a broad range of issues that affect international cybersecurity, cyberspace security, and oversees a unit of three officers covering global policy, plans and negotiations, international engagement and capacity building, as well as threat management and coordination. So that's quite a lot.
Then I have people.
I want to talk about tonight opening with adapting cyber policy amid shifting alliances. As we've seen, cyberspace is now increasingly geopolitical, and we've seen it reflect much of the realities of the geopolitical environment we're actually in right now. So drawing on your experience leading international negotiations with the US and regional cyber invasions, how should the US and its allies adjust their policies and strategies for cyber to navigate these changing dynamics? And how can the US continue to engage effectively in multilateral settings despite some of these pressures?
I think I followed the reference, but oh well. Well, good evening, everybody. Thanks so much for having me tonight. I really look forward to the discussion. And I think it's easy for me to start in response to that question by introducing what is now a maybe not so new Bureau for Cyberspace and Digital Policy at the Department of State, which is really the answer to the question about the changing geopolitics, the changing international environment, or shall I say evolving, perhaps, because it was part of Secretary Blinken's modernization agenda to create a bureau that would integrate not only what we had been doing on international cyberspace security in the department previously, what we had been doing on digital economy and international communications policy in the department for a long time, but also incorporate a component of digital freedom, which in theory would be infusing the human rights and values component into the discourse. So the Bureau was created 2.5 years ago, part of that whole process of the new administration, looking at how to modernize various aspects of modernizing foreign policy, but really to integrate and elevate these issues at the highest level. And I would say that that is probably the biggest evolution for a long time. Cyber policy, information communications or telecommunications policy, did not have necessarily the highest intention in the land, and certainly not in a foreign policy context. So bringing that tech diplomacy, as we call it now, to the top lines of our U.S. foreign policy is really the way in which we are responding, I think, to that global context. Just to mention that as part of that, we have followed suit with the National Cybersecurity Strategy, which called for forging international partnerships as one of the key pillars, and released in May the International Cyberspace and Digital Policy Strategy. And if anyone was at the RSA conference in May in San Francisco, you might have seen Secretary Blinken do just that, and that was incredibly fantastic, not only because he followed Matthew Broderick on stage, which was a highlight for me, but the other highlight was it was the first time that a sitting or any Secretary of State went to the RSA conference to make that exact argument that tech is important for our foreign policy and our foreign policy is important.
Yes, and it's part of the foreign policy, right? Integrate and elevate, I think, is something that is super important because it often doesn't have a home. It's often like spread out across a lot of different areas within the state. And I think that was definitely my experience with the Australian Prime Ministry. I want to shift to the impact of global conflicts on cybersecurity cooperation. I mean, we've made great leaps in the UN and other multilateral organizations with cybersecurity cooperation. But with the backdrop of major conflicts like Ukraine that we're seeing, how do these geopolitical tensions then influence the ability of nations to collaborate in cyberspace? And what challenges arise when we're aligning national interests with the need for collective cybersecurity, transnational efforts?
Well, I guess I would say nothing quite seizes countries when they are faced with either actual or imminent threats to their security. So, while it is, absolutely challenge, I would say, for us to think about, you know, the aggressive intrusion of Ukraine and how that, what that means for cybersecurity. It definitely has seized the community to work together. Not that we didn't do it before, but the urgency was tangible. And so nothing, just like many things in cybersecurity where nothing seizes the mind of a CEO or a federal CISO, like an actual incident on their networks, that really did coalesce the international community together. A lot of the challenges might have gone away immediately. We saw governments come together. We saw the private sector take sort of unprecedented steps to provide assistance into Ukraine. Fortunately, many of them were already there providing products and services, so that was leveraged. But we have made in the State Department, we've made a really concerted effort to bring together our partners to find ways to coordinate our foreign assistance to Ukraine to manage the conflict that they're in. Fortunately, for a variety of reasons, they have been very active and capable in their own defenses. But with such a great need, it was imperative that we were able to pull together countries in something that we now call the Tallinn mechanism to coordinate our foreign assistance. So A, we're not duplicating, and B, we're complementing what others are doing based on what Ukraine needs. So that is the kind of thing that I think the conflicts have really emphasizes, the need for what is the overarching tenet or overarching framework of the international cyberspace and digital policy strategy, which is digital solidarity. How can we work together to bring to bear our collective resources for countries in need? How can we stand together to hold states accountable when they engage in malicious cyber activity? And how can we build coalitions to impose consequences on those that do? We can talk more about digital solidarity all you want. It's part of our mantra now with regard to strategy and what that means and how we work together.
I mean, it's really galvanized, I think, a lot of partners around the world, right, for that event. In terms of building resilient cyber cooperation frameworks, what sort of innovation or innovative approaches or frameworks can ensure sustained cooperation in cyberspace going forward? And do you think there are any specific capacity building initiatives on emerging technologies like AI, one of my favorite topics, that can play a pivotal role in fostering collaborations, even amongst nation states with perhaps differing interests and different standards of power?
Perhaps I'll take that in two bits, one with regard to foreign assistance and capacity building, and one perhaps with the efforts that the administration and by extension we, the department, have taken on AI governance. The evolving environment, the increasing need for urgent incident response and assistance, as opposed to long-term capacity building, which we also still do, it required us to really look at how we could accelerate or make more efficient and effective our foreign assistance in an agile way. And we were able to, very grateful to Congress for providing us with a new dedicated cyber digital and technology fund to be able to provide assistance in more agile and flexible ways, including working with the private sector in our capacity building and foreign assistance to countries that need it on an urgent basis. Not only did they provide the authorities, but they also did provide the funding for that. So the fund is funded. We have been able to really leverage that to find ways to provide foreign assistance in a more agile manner. A couple of examples of times in which we've done that, where we struggled, I think, to provide that assistance in that quickly and in an urgent need. We're certainly Ukraine, we already talked about that, but also in the case of Costa Rica, where they suffered tremendous impact from a ransomware attack. And we were able to put together a package of foreign assistance that included not only helping to create a virtual SOC, but also to provide for cybersecurity best practices and tools and practices that they could engage to improve their own cybersecurity. The other one I would say, another example, is where we were able to provide similar assistance to Albania in the face of the attack that they sustained from Iranian actors, and similarly provide that kind of assistance. So the evolution is sort of iterative. For a long time, we provided foreign assistance, but we still do provide foreign assistance for countries figuring out how they could establish national strategies or national institutions for addressing cybersecurity in their national context. We've also provided assistance for countries that are looking to develop their computer emergency response teams and how they can respond to cyber incidents themselves. And a lot of that has to do with institution building, establishing a practice of working with the private sector. Eric mentioned Cyber Security Awareness Month and awareness and training are key components of that as well. But this sort of incident response is a little bit of our providing incident response is a little bit of an evolution in our foreign assistance funding and our projects. And I think that is indicative of sort of the geopolitical context, the increasing dependence and on technology in other countries around the world, and the greater desire by countries to really digitize themselves and do their own transformation. So there's all of these pieces coming together that really have required that we take a more modern approach. Now, it's not perfect, but we're working on it, and we have established great contacts with other donor countries to be able to provide that kind of assistance. I would talk about governance. On perhaps another side of the equation is looking at emerging technologies. And of course, many people would not necessarily call AI an emerging technology anymore. But with the onset of ChatGPT and large language models and things like that, I think it has also seized the mind. And certainly that seized the mind of the administration to get with companies that were engaging, that are AI companies, put together a set of principles of behavior that they would engage in that would provide for some understanding of how they were engaging in their businesses, and then take that globally, or respond globally. It was Japan that brought AI in a very robust way to the G7. It was the UK that brought AI to a AI for good or an AI savings summit. So there are a lot of constellations of discussions around AI governance. What are we going to do about how we provide for a set of principles or guardrails or things that make that the technology is not going to be something that people fear so much, but that it can be both securing AI, but also AI for cybersecurity.
I think there's a lot of comparisons of AI being the brakes on a car. If you're sort of driving really fast and you have some AI safety mechanisms as guardrails to ensure that innovation can still happen but at a safer pace. Yeah. I think you guys have all done great work on that. I want to talk briefly about the election interference issue, because as we know, there might be something in 2 weeks' time that I don't know if anyone here is following in the US.
What?
Yeah. don't know where that was, but with a focus on perhaps Iran, so with increasing concerns, you know, around foreign interference, how should the US approach the specific challenges posed by Iranian influence on these elections here? What measures can be taken to counter such initiatives whilst maintaining the integrity of the election processes?
Well, certainly we are not the only country dealing with that challenge around the world, but yes, it is coming into a great relief for us. We have always been concerned about election influence, even before it might have been on cyber wires. But certainly the ability of, to use the medium is a concern as well. And so I guess I would say two things. One is that we have been able to identify some of this activity and sanction actors that are engaging in influence, malicious site or malign influence in our election processes through dis and misinformation. The other thing I would say is that we do have efforts that are really geared toward building societal resilience. It's not my unit per se, but the department and of course the whole U.S. government is very seized with making sure that there is information integrity. And actually that's maybe a nice way to bring in this piece about the third element that I mentioned in the new bureau, which is on digital freedom. And information integrity is one of the key things that they're working on. And Secretary Blinken did an amazing speech about information integrity at the Summit for Democracy Part 2 in Korea to talk about this issue. So there are a number of things that we and the State Department are doing, but certainly across the interagency to address the security and integrity of democratic institutions in our election.
I have one last question before popping over to some pre-prepared audience questions. I think we've got quite a diverse range of audience members and readers within the country here. For some of the folks who are here tonight, they're in the private sector, working in government relations. They probably have a lot of things to read. So if you were to give them sort of three key takeaways from the strategy that we had mentioned, or actually two of the strategies, both the digital solidarity and then the international cyberspace and digital policy strategy, what would be one or two key takeaways you want the audience to walk away here?
Okay, I'm going to go with three. The first one is that the national cybersecurity strategy really does put forward two fundamental shifts in looking at cybersecurity. And the first one is to take burden away from the end users and put it on for things like national security and direct it more toward entities that are more able to take care of that. To some, that may sound like and may end up being, to some extent, additional regulations in this space. But the other side, the other fundamental shift is to incentivize long-term investment in cybersecurity. So I think that would be one thing I would say, particularly for private sector audience, but not only, just to keep in mind that those processes are underway. Digital solidarity is the overarching framework, the overarching tenet for the international strategy. And there are several key components of that, whether it's about regulatory harmonization with our partners, whether it's about capacity building, sort of the things I mentioned, standing together and providing assistance. There are a number of tenets that run across the strategy that incorporate digital solidarity. The other thing I would say is that it is, see if I can do this quickly. It is driven by an affirmative vision for technology generally. So that point I made about that this is a medium that has provided so much productivity and empowerment, and that's something we want to double down on. The second thing is that it really takes a look at the entire technology stack So not just, I don't know, not just the internet, not just 5G, or, you know, it really looks at everything that the digital ICT ecosystem incorporates. So whether it's from undersea cables to cloud computing, you know, I have said from sea to sky to incorporate satellites and things like that. So it really takes that whole digital ecosystem into account with regard to sort of building it, protecting it, and utilizing it for empowerment and around the world.
Fantastic. I think we've got time for one question from the audience. So it's from John Patrick, a real name, promise. What do you think is one of the biggest challenges you foresee that the world will need to overcome to ensure a secure future? Easy question. I think maybe we can sort of try and tailor that to the cyber realm, given that we are talking about future cyber defense.
I think, you know, you think of this in so many layers, and one is setting and preserving the international environment that we as open democratic societies want to preserve. And then it goes all the way down to sort of the use and of the technology and how individuals use it and how, you know, so they're really with the criminal act. I mean, so there's so many key aspects to that question. I guess if I were to pick one, I would put it in my own bailiwick, which is regard to deterring malicious cyber actors, whether they're states, state-sponsored, state-sanctioned, states-ignored, criminal activity emanating from states where we can't access that network or whatever it may be to really impose consequences and change the decision calculus that that leaders in these countries will make. I think that is probably the most near and dear to my heart. So it's, you know, everything from the discussions we have in the UN to the public attribution statements that we do when we're calling out malicious activity by states, and the things like sanctions and indictments that we do to try to hold actors, malicious actors, accountable.
Thank you for all you do, and thank you for coming here today. Please join me in thanking you.
I'm going to leave it because I don't know what to do with it.
So the next speaker in the hot seat is Dr. Matt Turek. Dr. Matt Turek is he's around the corner. He's the Deputy Director at the Information Innovation Office at DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Matt, I'm sorry we don't have music to walk them into. I feel like we needed some, you know, pump up music in the audience.
Well, we'll simply work it out.
Yeah, exactly. So Matt has been in this role since May 2022. A few things have happened since then, I can't imagine what. But in this position, he provides technical leadership and works with the program managers to envision, create, and transition capabilities that ensure enduring information advantage for the US and its allies. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Look, I wanted to talk about staying ahead in a competitive cyber landscape. So the US and its adversaries face a lot of threats. So how does DARPA prioritize and develop programs that help US and allies maintain an edge over global competitors? And what are some of the most pressing challenges in achieving this in the cyber domain, particularly when it comes to national security, in the next 10 years? I'm just going to give you a wide berth here.
And I think that's like a yes or no question. maybe not. So let me start with a little bit of framing about what DARPA is for those of you that are not familiar with us. So DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, we're part of the Department of Defense in the United States. We were created in 1958 in response to Sputnik. Sputnik was an event that was referred to as creating strategic surprise for the United States. What was that surprise? It wasn't the launch of that satellite. U.S. government knew that the Russians were working on it. In fact, it was the International Geophysical Year. U.S. was working on launching the satellite as well. It was the details and the size of the payload And the implications of putting that payload in orbit meant that you could put a nuclear payload on an intercontinental ballistic missile and hit the U.S. homeland. That created strategic surprise. Now, there was surprise for the public more generally, but that core element was the strategic surprise. Several months later, page and a half memo stood up what is now DARPA, originally the Advanced Research Projects Agency, with the goal prevent or perhaps create, that's an opportunity for us to prevent surprise, to create ourselves, prevent or create strategic surprise. So that's the mission of the agency. What that really means is we're looking to make transformational investments in technology. We want to change the game. So it's not about what's the next incremental piece, it's about making that transformational change. How do we do that? One of the really unique things at DARPA is the program managers. These are the people that we hire for term limited positions that bring in compelling technical ideas, and they sell agency leadership, who's also on the clock, on why we must do this now and how it's going to change the game. So that is really foundational to the DARPA model for creating transformation. And again, it's not about those incremental changes, it's about the transformational changes. I think the second part of your question was what about some of the threats and some of the challenges. So let me talk to that as well. I'm going to use the analogy that we refer to as sharp, right? So imagine in your head an iceberg where the top of it has a sharp fin. Okay, why is that the analogy? Well, for icebergs, the bottom piece, the piece you don't see below the water, is the biggest piece. And in this analogy, that really stands for technical debt in our complex systems. We've accumulated a massive amount of technical debt in our systems. And if you're on the Titanic, your strategy might be, well, I'm just going to avoid the icebergs. You can't forget the shark fin part. And that shark fin part is the adversary that's out there. It's the intent of the adversary to use that technical debt against you. So it's not just that the iceberg's floating, it might be coming for you. And so some of the challenges here, again, are we've created long-lived critical infrastructure systems. We haven't invested sufficiently in them. There's a massive amount of technical debt. We know, and the U.S. government has stated publicly, adversaries are pre-positioning themselves on critical infrastructure. Right? That's not for intel gathering purposes. That is to deny us the ability to exercise national values, most broadly speaking. And so, again, that is, I think, one of the most pressing challenges here is that really that accumulation of technical debt. Now, there's ways to get after that.
I'm going to look at shopping.
Switching gears to AI's disruptive impact, again, my favorite subject. So we've seen AI obviously change the dynamics in cybersecurity. From DARPA's perspective, what do you see as some of the biggest areas for potential, and what are some of the biggest challenges in your view? Now, we're talking sort of beyond kind of just AI, perhaps generative AI, but also agentic AI. So, talking to that, how do you think we're evaluating some of these technologies and the large language models that support them, especially in areas as consequential as national security application?
So lots of good questions there. Let me start first with something that I'm very excited about. Again, building on that notion of there's a lot of technical debt, particularly in critical infrastructure systems. DARPA's been running the AI Cyber Challenge for the last year. We have another year to go. If you haven't been following that, I encourage you to pay attention to it. What is that? That is actually an effort to use things like large language models in conjunction with formal reasoning systems to try and find and fix vulnerabilities at speed and scale in critical infrastructure software. We ran a semi-final competition and awarded prizes at DEF CON this year. The way that competition worked is we took some open source software associated with critical infrastructure, made copies of it, we inserted vulnerabilities in it, and we used it as a testing mechanism for an open competition for researchers to bring their best of breed cyber reasoning systems in conjunction with large language models. The teams were able to find about a third of the vulnerabilities that were associated. This is fully automated. So no humans in the loop, it's completely automatic. I'm even more excited about the fact that they could patch about 3/4 of those vulnerabilities that we found. And they did that fully automatically again. So that would give us a capability that you could run on an open source code base or another code base you have access to that would automatically find and fix those vulnerabilities. One of the other interesting pieces was that one of the teams found a zero day in SQLite. That is a widely used open source software package, well maintained. That zero day was responsibly disclosed and patched before it got announced. But that is some of the promise of AI. We have another year to go. We haven't released what the final competition is going to look like. Maybe there will be multiple events, but it will certainly culminate at DEF CON next year. So I encourage folks to pay attention to that. I think that would be a really interesting point in the cyber community. To address some of the other issues about like how do you evaluate AI systems and large language models, I think that's actually a really difficult problem. We have benchmarks, we have red teams, those are the state of the art, but they are insufficient in a number of ways. So one of the key investments that DARPA is making is really on foundational mathematical approaches for evaluating large language models. If you think about them, it's really complicated probability distributions, being generative AI. Are there more formal mathematics approaches that we can use to understand when are we going to get a right answer? How general will that answer be? What's the optimal architecture for something like a transformer given the problem set? Those are the sorts of questions that AI Quantify, AIQ, is set up to answer and is really actually mobilizing the mathematics community that hasn't been as deeply engaged here to get after some of these foundational problems.
Very cool. And I think we talked a little bit about this as well. It's very difficult for external third-party sort of assessors to figure out what safety level these large language models have, right? So let's talk about innovating for the future. I know we talked a little bit about DEF CON stuff, but how do you see balancing research and real-world application taking place in the next little while? Because, you know, with DARPA's focus on cutting-edge technology, how do you sort of, are there any specific projects or initiatives that you see as particularly promising for transforming how the US approaches cyber defense in the years ahead? And what is that game-changing, you know, leveling up is what Benzie say, in this patch?
Yeah. So again, as you said, DARPA's focus here is really on that transformational capability. Another thing that we're really excited about, we actually announced around the time we were running the DEF CON semifinals, is a program called Tractor. It's a great acronym. Translate all the world's C to Rust, right? So one of the—
Say that again, sorry, translate?
Tractor.
Okay.
Translate all C to Rust.
Right, remember that.
Yeah, and so, if you know C as a programming language, and one of the challenges is memory safe. C is not a memory safe language. It doesn't have the semantics to be able to deal with memory saving. Rust is. You can trivially translate and say unsafe, put a block of C. That doesn't really get you those memory safe semantics. Tractor has this ambitious goal. Can I translate C, which doesn't have these semantics, to Rust, which requires them? And those semantics and that understanding is going to have to come from somewhere, maybe things like large language models, maybe more traditional programmatic reasoning systems. But that's the goal of the Tractor effort. We're also looking at things like reinforcement learning and AI. Can we leverage reinforcement learning to train defensive cyber agents in something like a cyber gym? How would we use those agents? Well, they would be resident on your network, maybe in the presence of an APT, an advanced persistent threat that's sitting on your network, a threat actor. Can those blue agents take steps to slow down that threat actor, to move it to another part of your network? Now, they might have to give up some functionality to do that, but perhaps they understand, oh, these are the critical workflows that I need to protect. And that would be, again, transformational with respect to, oh, I found an APT on my network. I need to burn it all down. and stand up my network? Can we figure out how to operate through APTs? Can we quarantine APTs? Can we push them in areas where they'll be less impactful? So that's a program called CASEL that's already ongoing at Durham.
Yeah, fantastic. Let's talk about DARPA's role in public-private partnerships. What are some really exciting things that you all are working on that you want to highlight here before we jump to the audience questions?
Right. So going back to that AI cyber challenge at AICC, we could not execute that challenge without the partnerships of Google, Microsoft, OpenAI, and Anthropic. They provided to the competitors access to state-of-the-art large language models. So it was very much a partnership. They provided those resources, that access. Why did they do that? Well, presumably, partially because they care about cyber defense. They're also learning really valuable things about how people might use those large language models in the context of cyber defense. They get insights into what are the capabilities of my model? How might they compare to my competitors' models? What are relative strengths and weaknesses? How can people use these systems? So that has been a really valuable partnership. It continues for another year. We have more traditional ways of working with some unusual companies, or unusual perhaps from a DoD perspective. On our semantic forensics program, which is looking at, can we automatically detect, attribute, characterize falsified media? So think about generated AI media or human manipulated media. We have both NVIDIA and Google as funded research teams. We funded them to really be headlights for the program, to anticipate what's coming down the road from the perspective of generative AI. That was super valuable on the program. We had a really good collaboration, I'll use as an example, with NVIDIA, where we got early access to results from StyleGAN 3. Now, it's a couple years old, but you might remember that that was state-of-the-art image generation technology at the time. That allowed us to run experiments. Would Semaphore Defenses be able to pick up these generative AI outputs without any knowledge of the architecture or training data from them? NVIDIA hadn't released it, so there was no way for that knowledge to leak into the algorithms that that DARPA researchers, other researchers on the program produce. And in fact, we had very good performance on finding some of those samples. And so that's another example of how DARPA works with non-traditional performers.
Love to see what else they find out.
Yeah.
So we have two questions from the audience. One is from Alexander. So to what extent do you think AI influences a younger generation's reluctance to pursue careers in cybersecurity due to concerns about job security? And do you believe this impacts in the national security space?
So, I mean, we for sure need more human capital in cybersecurity, cyber defense, thinking about these sorts of challenges. So it would be unfortunate if the interpretation of the advances of AI is, I don't need to invest in going into that field. Like, that would be a tragedy from a US national security perspective. Now, is that role going to change over time? Almost certain, right? Like, with AI tools, cyber defense is gonna look different. Maybe it's a lot less rote. Maybe it's more automated. Maybe there's more high-level thinking and analysis that needs to be done. So I would certainly encourage high school students, college students, to be thinking about cybersecurity as a career. If you think about the attack surface of AI systems, we don't fully understand that. That's going to fall in the bin, broadly speaking, of cybersecurity and defending things like critical infrastructure, because competent AI systems might eventually become critical infrastructure. So while the role might not look like what it is now, it will for sure be necessary. So again, I would highly encourage young students, high school, college, that are interested in that area to continue to invest, because we certainly need you from a national security perspective.
Fantastic. And finally, this is a question from Kristen. How is DARPA thinking about balancing the ethical, legal, and societal implications of AI and frontier technologies? This is something you and I have spoken about, you know, briefly, but I'm curious to hear, you know, what you can share here.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. If you think about an agency whose mission is to change the world, Like literally the quote inside the agency is, if you don't invent the internet, you only get a B, right? Like that's the bar in the agency is creating the internet to get an A as a program manager. There's huge implications for society for that technology. So we need to be thinking about those ethical, legal, societal implications concerns. And that's one of the investments that the current agency director has made. We now have an embedded LC scholar in the agency for about a year or so. That's going to be a rotational position. Rebecca Krutoff is the inaugural embedded LC scholar. She comes to us from the University of Richmond Law School, has written about autonomy and cyber. She's been amazing. We are incorporating that in deep ways in the entire process about how we think about the life cycle of a program. When we're conceiving a new possible investment, when we're continuing to execute a program, and we're thinking about where does that program go? Do we transition to commercial industry? Do we transition to US government? All of those things have LC implications. I don't want to claim that we have solved this, far from it, but there are rich conversations happening as a matter of process now throughout the agency across the entire life cycle about how we think about programs. So that's for sure a good thing. Hopefully there's going to be some real innovation coming out of DARPA. We have embedded LC teams on some programs to actually advance how do we think about LC concerns. I'm trying to build a AI system that we might in some future use for something like battlefield triage. What are the day-to-day LC concerns as I go about developing that technology? What are good LC processes? How do I surface issues? How do I sign off? How do I consider signing off on that sort of technology, even to move from research and development to test and evaluation or to operational use? Lots of open questions, but we are investing our time and resources in embedding that process in the agency, embedding that process in programs, and hopefully we'll have some really rich findings to help share with the broader.
Thank you so much, Matt. If you'll hire an extra there, folks, you'd be interested in that one. Sounds fascinating.
So that's an opportunity to say something I forgot. So we are always hiring. Program managers are on a clock. So we have essentially embedded 25% turnover a year. So if you're interested in program manager roles, come talk with me. We have rich science, engineering, and technical advisor staff as well. So there are many opportunities in the agency.
Thank you so much. And see Liesl as well. I'm sure the State Department might be
So now I'm going to welcome, oh my gosh, I stole his microphone, Brandon Wales, who is the VP of Cybersecurity Strategy at SentinelOne. All situated. Okay, so how I'm imagining this conversation is, it's like we're gonna look back, we're gonna look current, and then we're gonna look like super current 2 weeks current. Okay? Or 13 days current. So you're an expert, all things cyber defense. Let's kind of dial in cyber defense. When the Russian-Ukraine conflict started on February 24th, 2022, there were instant cyber lessons to be learned. Can you dive into, when we had talked before, you were talking about some of the background, and you were working in government when that happened. So tell me a little bit about the cyber aspects of the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Sure. So, I think people, when they think about the Russia-Ukraine conflict, normally gravitate towards the fairly barbaric attacks that Russia has conducted against our buildings and hospitals, et cetera. But going back to the early stages of that conflict, the first strike wasn't a bomb or a missile. It was a cyber attack against Western critical infrastructure.
And was that before, everyone kind of knows February 24th, right? Was that?
Yeah, so it was right at the beginning of the conflict. And they wanted to disrupt Ukrainian command and control. So they went after a US satellite communications company, Viasat, and they disrupted their satellite over Europe. And it did affect Ukrainian command and control, their ability to actually communicate. And it also had impacts on other countries nearby in Eastern and Western Europe that relied upon the same set of satellites, because they understood that cyber gave them a unique advantage to disrupt the communications that they would not be able to compromise through their physical attacks and disruptions. And I think over the course of the conflict, the Russians continue to use cyber to enable physical disruptions and attacks. So they now are using cyber alongside of their physical attacks against Ukrainian operations, as well as obviously more traditional cybersecurity, more traditional cyber hacking to steal political and military secrets and compromise Ukrainian systems. So it has been a consistent part of that conflict, and I would argue in any future conflict.
Yeah, right. I mean, as it's now been over 2 years, how does the U.S., partners, allies, Ukraine, have they honed in on their cybersecurity abilities to then be able to respond to that? I mean, as you said, it's kind of gone on. Is there almost this like parallel cyber war going on? I mean, I guess it's all baked in, but.
Yeah, so you know, I think there's actually somewhat good news in that between 2014 and 2022, the Ukrainian government did a fair amount to improve their cybersecurity in response to attacks that were undertaken by the Russians in 2015, 2016. During those periods, they went out and actually targeted their power grids, caused disruptions in Ukraine. And Ukraine did begin to take it seriously. And then certainly in the months ahead, when the U.S. Had very good intelligence that a war was likely, there was a surge of work from both government in the United States, other parts of the West, as well as private sector companies to surge resources to help Ukraine improve its cyber defenses, improve its resilience. They moved certain capabilities to the cloud in neighboring countries. That all enabled Ukraine to withstand a lot of Russian cyber activity. And on the whole, Russia's cyber attacks had far less impact than their physical attacks did. So I think we have a good case study for what you can do with enough work, with enough time, and given some of the unique circumstances surrounding Ukraine that allowed them to withstand what Russia's doing. That being said, every day Russia is trying to get into Ukrainian networks. Sometimes they're successful, sometimes they're not. I know that Liesl talked a little bit about some of the work that the U.S. government has done through mechanisms like the Talon mechanism, et cetera, to move capability and resources to Ukraine to help them withstand what they're dealing with. But that work needs to continue because Russia's not stopping.
Yeah. You pointed that, right? There's been a lot of cases that can then be learned from and implemented. The Russia-Ukraine conflict will probably not be the last conflict that takes place. It hasn't been. We've seen that. I mean, there's many conflicts that are raging around the world. What, as we look from a sort of a broader set, so we look forward as there's different adversarial actors, what has been learned and then what can be deployed in the future from Washington's perspective?
Yeah, that's fairly broad, and oftentimes it's going to be much more tactical. What will make sense in a given circumstance and given the unique context? So there were things that Ukraine could do that are not necessarily available to other countries. So in the months ahead of the Russian invasion, Ukraine did things to improve its operational resilience. It literally drove servers across the border and were setting up capabilities in nearby countries at data centers and helping to ensure that their country could continue to access online digital resources. That may not be available in other conflicts. So in a case of conflict around Taiwan, for example, their ability to have offshore backup and capabilities will be limited by whether their communications to those countries could be maintained, and those capabilities are likely to be targeted for disruption, isolating Taiwan. And so the kind of capabilities you're going to want to deploy there may be a little bit different. The kind of defenses, the amount of resilience that you build into that infrastructure will have to be different given the context of that situation, the potential threats that they're going to face that are a little bit different than than what Ukraine was able to maintain, given its land borders with France.
So you spent over 20 years in government. Now you've gone to the dark side of private sector.
I'd like to say I'm a recovering faceless bureaucrat, current tech industry sellout, yes.
Nicely phrased. You know, there's a lot of talk always about what government can learn from private sector. You know, people say government moves like a snail. What is the relationship in terms of cyber and defense capabilities between private and public sector?
This is a place where no one has all the capability and answers by themselves. As we saw with Viasat, in cyber, the private sector is not on the front line. In many cases, they are the front line. They are going to be the ones that suffer the initial attacks. And when we look at what the U.S. government has talked about over the past 18 months with pre-positioning in our critical infrastructure by China to have the ability to hold that infrastructure at risk in for future conflict, those are private companies that are being targeted by our adversaries, hoping to one day turn them off, cause large-scale disruptions. So in cyber, our success is entirely dependent on the operational collaboration between industry and the government. We each have unique insights, capabilities, and expertise that need to be brought to bear. The government has obviously a lot of unique understanding of our adversaries. It has exquisite intelligence. The private sector has visibility into what is happening in the cyber ecosystem that dwarfs what the government has. The private sector can take action to move things at scale. Liesl mentioned the first pillar, the first major policy shift in the U.S. national cyber strategy is around moving capability to those best able to handle it, which is mostly moving it upstream. So trying to protect 150,000 water utilities one at a time is not possible, but all of those water utilities all depend on the same relatively small handful of technology providers. So if you can bake in additional security there, you can deal with, you can scale our security solutions in ways that the government could never do by itself, no matter what it could potentially want to do from a regulatory perspective.
Okay, interesting. So dialing in there, for example, would it be the government reaching out to these technological providers of the water systems, and how does that play and plug work, right? Is it someone getting ahead? Is it the water systems also thinking, hey, we are probably not prepared and this could be critical?
So we want this to be a real cohesive relationship. So it's not a matter of always one person reaching out to another. There are times when you want the federal government, because it has spotted some unique risk or it has some intelligence around a specific vulnerability or specific targeting by an adversary, to reach out and touch the private sector and say, we need your help addressing this specific threat. And that happens. But we also need it in the other direction, which is the private sector saying, we're seeing things happening, or we've noticed that a lot of our customers have X problem and we need your help to begin to close that. Or using the government's convening power, bringing together different companies in the same domains, whether they're competitors or not, to help tackle problems. You need this to be completely seamless. You know, there are places where this works now and it works well. There are places where there are barriers that prevent the open sharing of information between the government and industry. And I really think as we look ahead to the election, that we should be thinking about where are those barriers, what are the opportunities to tear down those barriers so that there is continued improvement in the way government and industry collaborate, because it is the difference between success or failure in cyber.
Right, right. Like, yeah, you can't just, you know, it's not separate swim lanes and we're all just living in our own world. We're kind of all connected in many ways by technology and cyber.
And it's not just here. I mean, these are global problems.
Right.
And so we need to have these same conversations with friends and allies overseas. They need to be having these same conversations with the companies that operate within their countries. In a global market where U.S. companies are acquiring technology from countries around the world, focusing only on the United States is insufficient. And so a lot of the efforts that we've seen the government undertake in things like secure by design, operational collaboration, also have to factor in our friends around the world.
Yeah, yeah. Just a curveball, really quick. I mean, cyber, when did you start working into cyber? When did it become like this item on the agenda? And even like you were saying, with different allies, different partners, this is now one of the bullet points, you know, that we are going to talk about when we talk to the Five Eyes, when we talk to Australia.
Sure. So, you know, I probably have come into the cyber arena a bit from the side. I started working at in the government on bigger ticket national security issues. When I first worked on the Hill, I was focusing on missile defense and arms control. Eventually made my way into DHS and was working on our infrastructure intelligence fusion, trying to understand how, at the time, in the early days of 2005, how terrorists wanted to exploit our critical infrastructure, targeting it, what we can do. Over time, the questions we started to get focused more on digital risks to that infrastructure. And that has accelerated over the past 15 years, where 20 years ago, the number of folks at DHS working on cybersecurity was probably around 100. And now, when I left CISA a few months ago, CISA was 3,000 plus people. The largest piece was our cybersecurity footprint. So it is a much different world now, given the nature of the threats. And I think we see from the attacks we've seen in this country, from ransomware, criminal organizations targeting by nation states, that we've had to change to meet the moment.
Right, yeah. It's just so interesting to see the evolution and how it's become so, because I think anyone in this room would know cyber is so important, but then you kind of dial in. All right, you touched on something earlier that I think we really want to get to the meat and the heart of, which is the election, and cyber influence, or just sort of foreign influence into the election. The DNI just released 2 days ago that they did a report from election day up to inauguration and sort of the threat in that period. Specifically, they touched on China, Iran, Russia. Those actors, they're often in those reports. Can you talk a little bit about what the interference in the election is, and then how that's deployed?
So I think we have been somewhat lucky in this election cycle. We've not seen foreign nations target our election infrastructure for cyber targeting the way we did in 2016 and to some degree in 2020. Now, the actors in 2016 and 2020 didn't really accomplish a whole lot with their cyber targeting of our infrastructure. In both cases, they mostly just gained access to voter registration systems, but never really were able to weaponize that in any kind of meaningful way. We have not seen, certainly not been released publicly, and I've not seen anything that indicates that there's been successful cyber targeting of our infrastructure to date, because, I mean, it's not going to happen, and that's certainly something that election officials and federal government are very focused on. We have seen and will continue to see aggressive use of disinformation and foreign influence operations trying to undermine the American people's confidence in the election and to sow discord and distrust. Now, this is not new. They've been trying to do this for years, and they will attach themselves to any polarizing issue. We have seen foreign disinformation actors stoking fervor around things like Justice Kavanaugh nomination, abortion, gun rights, etc. Anywhere where the American people are tightly pitted against each other, they are going to engage. And I think elections tend to bring that out, and they are very focused on it. And I think why you're seeing the DNI, their report a couple days ago, focus on the period from Election Day to the inauguration is that they have seen from previous election cycles that during that period of time, when there are questions about who won, when there is recounts underway, when emotions are high, that is a time in which they think that there is a high degree of susceptibility to their disinformation, and will get the most play, that it will help to achieve their goals, which are dividing Americans and undermining their trust in their election system. Now, having looked at this for 8 years when I was in government, I have very high confidence that the will of the American people will be accurately conveyed in the election. Those systems are very secure. There's multiple layers of protection and security. But any problems, of which there are with computers every day, that are very innocuous, but in this environment, any problems we played up as someone is interfering with the election, when in almost all cases that is not going to be the case. But we will be, unfortunately, too many people will be conditioned to think that that is real, and our foreign adversaries are going to use that. They're going to try to use that at our expense. And a lot of this will come down to the American people about whether they buy into bullshit that is going to be fed to them by our adversaries, hoping to weaken us.
And I mean, just to close, I guess you touched on, you know, you're fully confident in the ability, and right, and there's a lot of training that goes into that. If someone works in election interference, but specifically from a cyber lens, what have they been doing over the past year? How do they kind of train up and foresee potential interference that could occur?
So there's been a lot of work over the past 8 years to bolster the cybersecurity capabilities of the officials who manage our election infrastructure. You know, constitutionally in the United States, elections are managed at a very local level. And so this burden largely falls on state and local election officials who are the ones responsible. Now, that decentralized approach actually adds a lot of resilience to the system. You cannot get into one place and affect the entire thing. That poses a huge challenge for an adversary hoping to achieve certain goals, because you cannot do it at scale. The systems that we use to actually vote, you show up at a polling place, those systems are not internet connected. The adversary could not affect them from afar. So there are, it is not just about training them for to detect it, but it's a matter of how do they build these systems and put in place multiple layers of protection. So there is obviously a lot of cyber protections they put around these systems that are internet connected, like voting registration systems and the unofficial election reporting systems, but there are multiple layers of additional protections. They do pre-election testing, they do post-election audits to make sure that the paper ballots that 97% of people in the country vote on accurately match the results from the tabulations from the machines. And that those layers of protection, those the resilience that's built in, and the work that's been done over the past 8 years to build better cybersecurity into our systems are why I have such confidence in this system.
Yeah, and just to close, I mean, I'm curious sort of on a personal note, after leaving government after 20 years, what is your relationship like now? I'm sure you work with so many government partners every day. How is it stepping into sort of different shoes?
Yeah, so I try to make sure that they know not to deploy me when they see me coming, because they've been trying to sell them some Sentinel-1 EDR. You know, I'm lucky enough to not work, not to do that part of the Sentinel-1 business. I tend to focus more of my work day-to-day with our private sector clients, helping them think through their security strategies. But I still stay, obviously, in close touch with a lot of former friends and colleagues, because this is a space, as we just talked about, where Sentinel-1 as a part of the cybersecurity ecosystem from the private sector has things to contribute. I still want to be able to lend my voice to this community through things like this. And I want to be able to help provide support to the work that the government is doing on behalf of all of the American people to make us more secure.
Yeah, all right. Well, you're in charge of strategy, so we're looking at you. All right, Brandon, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Fantastic. Well, please stay in for a drink and mingle, and thank you again for coming tonight.
The bar is still open.
Yes, the bar is still open. Thanks, Rachel.